Hey everyone, Tom Salemi here. Welcome back to Device Talks Weekly. We have a bit of an historic episode for you. Kayleen Brown, our amazing managing editor, will be leading the keynote conversation with Jyoti Gira. She is CEO of Cardiovascular Interventional Solutions for GE Healthcare. Before that, at the start, Paul Grand, the CEO of MedTech Innovator, will be on hand. He'll join the newsmakers. He is the newsmakers because he's revealing the finalists for MedTech Innovators programs. And that conversation got a little cut. We had some technical difficulties, so we'll start a little in the middle, but you'll pick right up where you're supposed to. And lots of really fascinating startups in that program, and a lot of worthy finalists that you'll see on the stage at AdvaMed. And then in between those two great conversations, we've got a FOMO featuring Chris Statham, the VP of Technology at Aptics, and you can hear more from Chris and from Eric Leopold of Aptics at on our Device Talks Tuesdays that's coming up on this Tuesday, September 30th at 4 p.m. The title is Build a Better Implant, Harness the Potential of EPTFE. Go to devicetalks.com to register. You can watch that live. You can watch that on demand. Get your questions answered either way, but be part of that MedTech conversation. And we also want you to be part of Device Talks West, which is happening on October 15th and 16th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. You can always use the code DTWeekly25 to save 25% off the price of registration. If you're still not convinced, feel free to ping me on LinkedIn. Let me know what your questions are. We'd love to have you as part of that two-day MedTech celebration. Tim Schmidt of Johnson & Johnson, Ray Cohen, formerly of Axonics, and Azdwa of Moon Surgical, Iman Jetty of Intuitive, Josh Machauer of Stanford Biodesign. Those are just the keynotes. We've got lots of great stuff in between. So make sure you join us at Device Talks West. Go to west.devicetalks.com to register. All right, let's begin this episode of Device Talks Weekly. Let's go. All right, you ready for this?
Ready.
And for folks hearing that voice, of course, I'm sure everyone recognizes the dulcet tones of Paul Grand, CEO of MedTech Innovator. Paul, welcome. Welcome to Device Talks Weekly.
Thank you, guys. Great to be back here in the booth with you guys talking MedTech.
Yeah. It's always an honor.
Yeah, very happy to have you here. We usually have you here prior to Device Talks Boston or just before your big shoe at AdvaMed. You've got your big finals coming up in just a couple of weeks.
Yeah, no, it's incredibly exciting. You know, every single year, as you guys know, as longtime fans and associates and friends of MedTech Innovator, you know, it's a huge process. We spend literally an entire year building up to where we are at this point in our cycle, in selecting companies from all over the world, literally thousands of companies applying, choosing those companies to be in our accelerator, and then leveraging this unbelievable network of all the strategics and service providers and professional societies and payers and healthcare providers and all these other people to get together to try and make these companies the best they can possibly be. And then after all that mentoring work, we wrap it all up at the AdvaMed MedTech conference every year.
That's fantastic. And we'll be running out this news on Mass Device, so keep an eye out for that. And, you know, senior editor Sean Hooley is going to be at the AdvaMed conference, as well as Tom, you and Kayleen are going to be there as well. So I'll be
representing Device Talks. Kayleen will keep the machine running back at the home office. So.
Oh, cool, cool.
But I will be there, yes. And Very cool. We'll put a link in the Mass Device article about this in the show notes. We're recording this on Tuesday as the finalists are being announced. This will obviously come out on Friday, but folks, if you want spellings and more details, make sure you look for the link in the show notes. One of these companies will be a future guest on Device Talks Weekly because we're always honored to feature the winner of the afternoon session, on Device Talks Weekly. We had Samay last year. We had FIACS a few years ago, both of which, by the way, will be presenting at Device Talks West on October 15th and 16th. All of these companies are invited to attend Device Talks West. I'll share a code with you, Paul, so you can invite them to attend that, and we would love to have them. They have a free ticket to present at a future Device Talks event. So, Paul, why don't we start with the Execution Award finalists again? These folks will be presenting earlier in the day on October 7th, correct?
Correct. They will be part of the Excel Leadership Forum, which is really programming focused during the conference on October 7th around startup companies, things like investor panels, you know, how do you raise capital, all that kind of stuff. What's, you know, who are the people investing today? During that programming, we will have the Execution Award competition. So it'll be in that same room. And these are four companies out of, as I said, that overall cohort of 45 early stage companies who are just knocking it out of the park in execution. All right. According to their mentors, by the way, this isn't my pick. These are the people at those large med tech companies who made these recommendations.
Excellent. All right. Let's roll with number one of the execution class.
All right. So I'm going to go through these four companies in no particular order. So first, VQ Biomedical. Galen Robertson heading the company, who will be presenting. So this is a minimally invasive catheter that diffuses oxygen directly into the bloodstream in patients with respiratory failure. So essentially, let's get rid of ECMO and let's replace it with VQ Biomedical. That is the value proposition.
ECMO does a fantastic things, but there are also just complications around it. And, you know, it's usually being used on very sick people. So, you know, some kind of new technology that could help people out sounds.
Yeah. I mean, a minimally invasive catheter that can do what ECMO does, that's pretty incredible, totally, right? Yeah. So amazing, right? And this company's executing incredibly well, which is really the key for this competition. So, you know, I would expect these guys in any scenario to be on a future episode of Device Talks because these are the companies that are just going to be killing it in the future.
Our next finalist.
The next one is Lighthearted AI Health, and that's Lucrezia Chester. So Lighthearted AI has a product called the LightScope, which is an AI-powered laser that is able to accurately diagnose heart disease without a clinician. So it literally is like shining a laser on your neck and able to actually diagnose heart disease without a clinician.
Wow.
Super cool. It's part of our American Heart Association cohort, which is really cool. We have 8 companies this year that are being mentored by the American Heart Association. That were selected by them, again, out of hundreds and hundreds of the applicants. So they're one of those companies. Really high potential.
That's company. Great. Now, I mean, I think we're at a time where we need more than the traditional cholesterol measurements and things to measure cardiovascular health.
Yeah.
There's CT cardiac scoring now, things that can actually get a look at the vessels and tell you what's going on in there. And I think as we get more physical evidence of heart health and cardiac health, I think that's a great thing. So sounds like a very promising area.
And we need, and we clearly need new technologies in general to do this that can hit the mainstream. Absolutely. So, you know, this is important. Yeah,
right. I know this next one.
Our next one, Synaptica Therapeutics, Ken Marish, leading the company. So this is another one of our American Heart Association cohort companies. And they have non-invasive neuromodulation of the default mode network for Alzheimer's. They've had 2 successful phase 2 trials and no serious side effects. Wow. So literally a device to treat Alzheimer's with serious clinical data already in their pockets. So this is one of those, like, when these guys were pitching during our road tour, which is a big part of our process and meeting with like hundreds of experts along the way, this is an opportunity for a lot of people to stand up and go, that'll never work. And everybody was like, this is a game changer. So, you know, you don't hear game changer from people at organizations like the ones that are our partners very often. You know, these are people who've seen everything and they're like, okay, this thing could be game changer for Alzheimer's with a device therapy.
You had Ken Marish on the podcast a few months ago. Ken and I talked because I was really I was one of those people. You get a lot of these pitches and you're like, all right. And then you, with Synaptica, I started reading it. I'm like, well, this is actually very interesting. And Ken and I had a great conversation. You know, we both had experience. My mom had dementia and probably Alzheimer's, and just the notion of buying someone a few more months, a few more years, be able to meet a grandchild that they wouldn't have met otherwise, or enjoy a wedding that they would not have seen. This is just important work. So, great choice. If I had an Oprah Book Club kind of sticker, I'd be like,
right. They get that DT Weekly sticker. All right, you know, it's a badge of honor.
Exactly.
All right, I know who your favorites are already. Okay, Tom. So then we have. Let's not bias the audience overly biased. So then there's Wavelet, because it is an audience vote. By the way, the audience will be picking the winner at the conference. Wavelet is our fourth company. So Wavelet is developing a non-invasive fetal EEG technology to detect real-time fetal distress. And obviously that improves outcomes for both mother and baby. And there's a lot of companies, you know, we've seen lots of people trying to do some of these non-invasive sensors in this space. Again, Wavelet is just knocking it out of the park. And the companies that are both in the cardiac space and in just general health data monitoring were the ones who raised their hands and said, oh boy, this one's important. And we really like it. Liz Golden, mm-hmm. the CEO, is terrific. And so Wavelet is the fourth of the companies in the execution award competition.
Paul, before we get into the finalist names, just for a moment, what have they been doing for the past 8 months or so? They've been out there presenting part of your program. What is a life like? What is life like for the cohort?
So the cohort during the accelerator. So the last 8 months or so, you mentioned the beginning part of it during the intake. They're pitching to not only to the strategic and other organizations that I just mentioned, but also to healthcare providers and insurers, payers, government agencies. All sorts of people are involved in the selection process, and we're giving them feedback and coaching. So that's like the early phases, if you will, of an American Idol, where they're out there meeting with everybody and giving them some tips. And then we select the companies for the accelerator. That's the last 4 months. So the actual accelerator itself is where they're getting mentored. So we start off with an assessment where we literally go through and kind of diagnostically look at everything these companies are doing in their product development, their regulatory, their reimbursement or payment plans, you know, and generally market access strategies, and the company itself, the team and all those things. We look at all those things and we assess their ability to succeed. We look at their plans, you know, what have they done so far? What have they accomplished? What are they planning to do in the future? And where are the risks? So it's a risk mitigation program. We go through and we say, what are the risks? And we try to address each of those risks. We make sure they're doing a good job, that they have the capability, and we assign mentors to fix the things that we are concerned about, or that the companies identify themselves and say, hey, we really, you know, we've been successful so far in Europe, for example, but, you know, we don't understand the U.S. market. And we really need to understand that. And so they may self-identify that those things, even if we don't diagnose them. And then we assign mentors specifically to do that. So both at the strategics, the professional societies and specialty societies, as well as service providers and others, are assigned to these companies specifically to address the concerns that we have and get these companies on the right track. I hear mentors all the time afterwards say something to me like, boy, am I glad we work with those guys. They were on the wrong track. And that is a real thing. They'll say like they got some bad advice from somebody else and they were just doing it wrong. And now they're doing it right.
That's fantastic. I mean, it's fantastic to have that kind of access to that kind of expertise.
Yeah. And it's free, by the way. Like we're not charging them. We're not charging them for that advice. So, you know, and that's the best thing too, right? Like none of these companies are like two or three, you know, guys and gals in a lab somewhere, you know, at a university who think maybe someday they'll leave and start a company. These are all funded companies. These are the people who you're like, oh, they're on the way already. They've already had their seed round. They've already had their A round. Sometimes their B round. Sometimes they're clinical. Some of these guys are like on the market. A bunch of these companies that we've talked about and that we will be talking about for the final, like they're entering the market in Q1 2026 in some cases. Like, this is real. This is the real deal. They're FDA approved in many cases. And yet they still have a menagerie of mistakes to make ahead of them that, that you know, I always like to say, unfortunately, most of the startups in the med tech space that we all know fail. Mm-hmm. And most of them do fail, by the way. And most of them fail for reasons that were preventable. You know, it wasn't that, like, the device didn't work. You know, the device worked. It's just they totally blew their, you know, their strategy for how they were designing the product and developing it. They blew the market access strategy. They went after the wrong indication, or they spent all the money on a study that nobody really cared about. And they thought, like, okay, now we'll fix it later, but nobody wants to fund them anymore and the company fails. So what we're doing in MedTech Innovator is making sure those really promising companies achieve the maximum value possible. So that's what the accelerator is all about. Absolutely. And these people, they spend at least 3 or 4 hours a week. Fantastic. With us, at least.
All right. Well, let's roll out the five finalists who will be appearing on stage at 3:30 p.m. at AdvaMed on October 7th.
All right, here we go. So again, in no particular order, first up, Luminoa. Headed up by Neil Piper. So this is a company that is setting a new standard in the care of chronic disease with a closed-looped enteral nutrition system. So instead of you know, one of those tethered systems that you see people tethered to for feeding and for enteral nutrition, this is a totally mobile system that looks almost like a pager you clip to your belt. Everything is self-contained. The you know, whether it's a child or whether it's an adult, they can actually get a personalized closed-loop nutrition system now with Luminoa. And it really is not just about the mobility, which is important, but also it's that closed-loop feedback. There's actually a huge mortality problem from malnutrition. Wow. And it's not, you know, always, you know, recognized, but it's massive. You know, billions and billions of dollars of healthcare spend are unfortunately due to malnutrition that could have been prevented with a system like this. Fantastic company, great CEO who comes from the industry, but who had a personal connection because of his son that led him to this epiphany to start the company.
I mean, is this, this is probably, this might be a silly question, but is this replacing like kind of like basically like the IV bag with the nutrients, you know, running down to somebody's arm or?
Yeah, it's replacing the nutrient, you know, the disposable nutrient, you know, packs and bags and all those things. It's replacing all sorts of things. Ultimately, for, you know, they might partner with some of those companies, yeah, as well, but ultimately, you know, it is a, wow, system for enteral nutrition. So all the things that you might think go into the pumps and all those things and the bags and all that are going to be replaced potentially by this technology, or certainly, as I said, partnered with this technology. It is, you know, I mean, an analogy could be if you want to look at like diabetes and there's like, you know, the people who make pumps or sensors and all those things to make a closed loop system, because this is a closed loop system.
Yeah.
So, you know, do you deliver all of that yourself in one system, like an insulin or somebody, or are you somebody who's just, you know, you're developing your Dexcom and you have the CGM? You know, so Luminoa could be the whole package. Or maybe partnered with people as well.
Fantastic.
Next, we'll get to Armor Medical. That's headed by Kelsey Mayo. Their product is called Armor, and it is a non-invasive real-time monitor to detect early hemorrhage. They're launching in the market for maternal health. So basically, During delivery, you know, you have a lot of women who suffer maternal hemorrhage, and people don't know it. And that leads obviously to you know, very poor outcomes, potentially including death. And this is something that can detect the, you know, these changes, in blood flow earlier so that people can intervene. And so you can, you know, you can obviously have improvements, obviously, in the outcomes, but overall, it, it dramatically improves workflow efficiencies and everything related to delivery when it comes to maternal bleeding. You know, you picture like, you know, things where, you know, companies look at like sponges and things to see how much blood was lost and all that. This is like a device that looks like an Apple Watch that you just wear on your wrist, and it's able to do this, this kind of detection. But, you know, that is the vision for the company. You know, could have just a huge impact both on maternal health, as well as,
I'm just curious, is there some kind of, thing that could be done with this with placental previa? You know, just because, I mean, I know that there's like wings of like children's hospitals where, you know, you have, you know, women who are pregnant with that condition who are just like, they seem fine, but, you know, they need to be monitored because, you know, something can go very, very badly.
Yeah, I think any condition where, you know, where blood is the issue is where this company in particular, because of the way they're looking at, you know, the way they're monitoring the blood and blood flow and changes, I think that's really where this technology will be applicable.
Fantastic. Yeah, definitely. So
exciting stuff. Kelsey's a terrific CEO. She's going to do a great job on stage. Our next company, number three in the finals, is Rivana Medical, headed up by Will Malden. And this is a company that is using AI enhance, or AI-enabled imaging solutions for point-of-care spinal needle interventions and musculoskeletal trauma. So this is, you know, something, for example, like epidurals would be an example of where this technology would be used. So it's their own proprietary AI-enabled imaging solution. They have, by the way, had huge support from BARDA, which is the agency in our government that's focused on health security innovation. So they've got some technology that has all sorts of application. And this is one particular use of that technology. They've had a huge amount of non-dilutive funding and some decent equity funding as well. So it's really interesting to see this company now coming out here at MTI in the finals with this technology. We've had other companies in the area of, you know, epidural and other spinal needle intervention in the past, but like this is, you know, this one is, it's again, one of those game-changing technologies potentially.
I love it. Is there a trend, is there like any thoughts on, I'm starting to kind of see a trend here that a lot of your finalists, you know, at least this year, seem to be doing things connected with maternal health. I mean, was it just a coincidence this year, or is there something more going on? Because I mean, I do know that there's been, you know, talk over the years that, you know, med tech and healthcare isn't, you know, as helpful for, you know, women versus men, you know, especially because, I mean, a lot of the decision makers are still men. I mean, was there something that, you know, is there a conscious movement to give that area more attention, or was this just more that, like, the stuff that was like really game changing, exciting this year just happened to be in that area?
I think I think there's no question that we've had an increase in looking for technologies this year, in particular in the women's health space. And that was largely due to our partnership with the American Heart Association. They have a venture fund that's called Go Red, and that's specifically looking at women's health. And when I say women's health, it's not just technology that affects women's organs. It's looking at technologies that affect diseases that disproportionately affect women. So that could be things like stroke and dementia and other things as well. Things like, you know, immunocompromised diseases that again, mm-hmm. disproportionately affect women. All of those things could be candidates for this particular cohort we did with American Heart. And in the case of Rivana, they are not part of the American Heart cohort. But yes, you're right. There are ultimately, if you look at the finals in particular, and you look at these things, there are a bunch of companies that that do affect women's health more disproportionately than we probably have in the past. So
that's great. Yeah, it's good to see that focus growing, and it's great to you know hear that the American Heart Association too is like upping its focus. I mean definitely like heart problems, like guys like us who are starting to get a little bit older, like everybody's like, yeah, you better look after your heart here. But I mean, there hasn't been that, as much of that attention for women.
Yeah, and it's heart and brain too, they're focused on, because there's neurovascular and all those parts of this as well that
fall under stroke risks.
Stroke and all these things in American Heart. So anyways, but again, I'm not saying that Ravana was mentored by AHA. They were not. But we're definitely having a American Heart, women's health focus this year
in
the overall cohort of 65 companies. And as I mentioned, two of the companies that were in that execution awards that we talked about, Lighthearted and Synaptica, both American Heart Association selected and mentored companies. All right. You want to keep going? Two more to go?
Yes, let's keep going. Two more to go.
We're almost there. Sorry.
Here we go.
I'll stop chatting.
that's why we're doing this, right? We love chatting. All right. Two more to go. SutureTech is the fourth company. So this is headed up by Oki Anakwenze. So the RapidFix, that's their device, is a soft tissue staple. It's the first one ever that is made of suture material that provides industry-leading efficiency and outcomes. So what do we mean by this?
Wow. Engineered materials, huh?
Yeah. So we're talking about a delivery technology for things like rotator cuff. I mean, not just delivery. I mean a device, the whole thing, delivery, the device, everything, all in one system that is incredibly rapid. That's the name, the RapidFix. Because when they look at their data, you can see that when you go in to do things like rotator cuff repair, so this is anything for tendons and ligaments, their technology is applicable to at SutureTech. But their first product is rotator cuff. And when you look at things like rotator cuff, the people with really bad outcomes is when the procedures were long. And usually the procedures were long because they were complicated. And as the surgeons will tell you, like the founder, you wind up with this thing that looks like a suture salad, where you've got all this stitching all over the place. It's just a mess. And that's what it winds up with in these long procedures, versus the RapidFix, which is a device that just comes in and just goes right in and places this entirely suture material made staple into the tissue, and it's rapid. So the outcomes should be better based on that. But also, of course, based on the biomechanical properties of their technology. So awesome stuff, should have a huge impact. I mean, it's crazy because I don't know if you guys knew this. I didn't know this going into this, that when they go and they do like things like a rotator cuff repair, at least 30% of those will result in a re-tear where that repair failed. And, so one in three of these things are failing at least.
Have to go back in and do something again.
Yeah, or never, and then live with the rest of your life where you can't like open a door and you can't lift things and you can't have a normal quality of life. So it's insane that the standard of care is like 30% failing for these repairs, and this technology hopefully will make a huge impact on that.
I think we all have a vision of shoulder surgery being minor, and it may be minor in the surgery, but the recovery takes forever, just forever. You're and you can't move your arm for several weeks, if not over a month, and it's not a simple procedure at all for the patient. So
yeah, no, it's
improvements
it's not.
Here are needed.
And can you imagine going through all that recovery,
then having to do it again,
only to have it re-tear when it needs at least 30% of the time? Yeah. So now you're living with again. You probably, a lot of these people aren't going back. At least 15% of the original surgeries, people go back in for a revision. But as I said, so 15% do a revision, 30%+ are having a re-tear, which means 15% of those patients who've had a surgery are just going, well, it was so terrible the first time. Right. I'm not going to go back and fix this.
Yeah,
I'm not going to go live with this pain for the rest of my life. lack of mobility and all the, I mean, you know, movement and all these things. So, boy, I mean, this is a game-changing kind of technology. Surgeon, innovator who saw the need. Some of our strategics, obviously, in the orthopedic space were the ones who were mentoring this company. And it wasn't just one. It was two of the large cap med tech companies who said, I want to work with this company. That's not always the case at MedTech Innovator. Usually it's like one strategic. So we had two in this case, plus a venture group. So anyways, the point is really promising stuff.
Fantastic. All right.
And honestly, everything, Paul, everything you've mentioned sounds like it could like actually make like a really positive difference for people. So, I mean, this is fantastic. And so, okay, well, here's the last, what's this last one we got here?
The last one we've got also is another one of those kind of game-changing technologies. The company is called Stentit, led by Bart Standard. So Stentit is really interesting. So this is a technology, you heard stent in the name. This is a technology that allows reconstruction of arteries and treatment of arterial disease, but without any drug. It's purely device. And it basically reconstructs the artery from the inside out as this device resorbs. So resorbable stent-like technology that doesn't have any drugs, there's no drug eluting, purely in a mechanical way can rebuild the arteries. And by the way, you might say this is one of those like this was their PhD thesis kinds of things that turned into a company and you go, oh, that's interesting. That'll never work. They're already at first in man. So this company is much more advanced than you might think. Still has a long way to go. Obviously, like, you know, all sorts of companies to prove all these things, but really, you know, kind of game changing technology. One of the evaluators during our road tour who had said she had spent good part of her career in stents said, well, you know, look, it's early, but this could be the most game-changing thing, most disruptive thing I've ever seen in stents. You know, that's the kind of stuff we want to put up on the final stage at MedTech Innovator and at the MedTech Conference.
I mean, it sounds like it's a long way to go, of course, but still, yeah, I mean, it sounds like this could be like a next generation of where we're going with stents, which...
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So let's reconstruct the arteries completely. Like really exciting stuff. So, you know, again, five companies in the finals that any one of them, I always like to say to people when they're like, how can you trust the audience to pick the winner for your $350,000 prize? Don't you want to pick the winner? And I go, no, because the secret is you could throw a dart and any one of these companies should win that prize. It really is true. Any one of these companies I just mentioned is fully deserving of winning. So it's not like, oh, there's one of these companies is terrible and the other, and the audience will figure that out. These are five great companies and we're going to leave it up to the audience to pick the one they think is the best. But ultimately, all five of these companies are really incredible.
Fantastic. All right. Well, once again, I'm excited to see who the winners are. We'll be highlighting them in the future, either on this podcast or at one of our meetings. Just to recap, so for the execution award, we have VQ Biomedical, Lighthearted AI Health, Synaptica Therapeutics, and Wavelet. And for the final award, the big ceremony that'll be taking place at 3:30 on October 7th at AdvaMed, we have Luminoa, Armor Medical, Ravana Medical, Suture Tech, and Stentit. So great.
Those are the gonna
be a tough choice.
Tough choice. And Chris Newmarker, I'm going to channel you right now. I'm going to channel you. So if you are out there in the audience and you are listening to this and you're saying, hey, October 7th, I'm going to be at the MedTech Conference and I'd like to go and be in the audience and vote for the winner, to choose the winner, because every vote absolutely counts. We've had votes that literally came down to literally one vote made the difference between first place, which is $350,000, and second, third, fourth, and fifth place, which is $25,000 each. So that's a big difference. One vote could literally determine the difference. I'm going to challenge you, Chris, and say, be on time to be on,
that's right.
to be on time is late, you want to be early. Get in line because the finals are huge. It's 3:30 p.m. on October 7th on the keynote stage. Do not show up at 3:45 or 4 or 4:30 and think you're going to get to see the finalists and vote. You got to get there on time at 3:30 or maybe even a little bit early, as Chris would
set the timer. To be early is to be on time. To be on time is to be late. To be late is to be left. So get over there.
Paul Grand, always a pleasure. Look forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks, sir.
Look forward to seeing you guys, too. Thank you, as always, for having me on Device Talks. I love this podcast.
Now, we love you, Paul Grand. Thanks for being on the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Now, it's our FOMO segment featuring Aptics. If you want to hear more from Aptics after this conversation, make sure you register for our upcoming Device Talks Tuesday. It's happening at 4 p.m. on Tuesday. Build a better implant. Harness the potential of EPTFE. Chris Dedham will be on with Eric Leopold, Beth Harrison-Meyer, and myself. And it'll be a great conversation. You can join live and get your questions answered right away, or watch on demand and get your questions answered less right away, but certainly soon after you ask them. So make sure you go to devicetalks.com to register. Now let's hear this episode's FOMO. Well, I'm here with Chris Dedham. He is Vice President of Technology at Aptics. Chris, thanks for joining us on the Future of MedTech Opportunities series.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
We're going to dive into the importance of designing of delivery systems. But before that, we always love to understand our guests' motivation. I understand that you, like a lot of folks in MedTech, have a real sort of personal connection and a personal story about medical technology. What drew you to your interest in implants?
Yeah, I appreciate the question. You're absolutely right. Early in my career, I was working in the interventional side of the business, and my father became ill and needed some vascular implants. And, you know, that's great that the technology was available. It extended his life, but not really the quality of his life. Mm-hmm. Really had a lot of complaints about the pain of recovery, the pain of surgery, and all that goes along with having these serious interventions. And, you know, I wasn't working in that area. That wasn't where my career was. And it took a long time for me to pivot into that area. It never left my mind. You know, it's a lot of these things are genetic. It could be me in the future. But it really took a while to get there. And then here at Aptics Interventional here in Charlotte, we've been able to focus on interventional technologies and specifically implants and delivery systems. And that's been extremely rewarding.
So as you mentioned, we're seeing incredible advances in medical device innovation, from new materials to energy sources. How are delivery systems evolving in step with the implants that they're designed to support?
They're trying to keep up. Mm-hmm. Delivery systems need to do a little better. The devices are getting smaller. They're more intricate, and they're oftentimes deploying in novel ways. The delivery tools still need to give doctors precise control and real-time feedback. And that means like better steerability through this tortuous anatomy. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes with these more intricate devices, a staged release mechanism. You know, they may want to start a proximal to distal, distal to proximal, and there could be other components along the way. They also need to integrate markers for imaging, and oftentimes now even more sensors, so that the physicians can actually see what they're doing as they go through the procedure. But thankfully, more often now, implants and delivery systems are being developed together, and this is leading to better performance and a much smoother physician experience. In many ways, delivery systems are kind of the unsung heroes of the procedures. As my colleague, Eric, likes to remind our engineering teams, you know, it really doesn't matter how great an implant is if the delivery system can't deploy it accurately. So, you know, we really believe it's critical that the delivery systems and implants are developed together.
So are there still design gaps that exist between the two, between implants and delivery systems when they aren't developed in tandem?
There sure can be, and oftentimes are. In particular, you know, when we have these gaps, they lead to really poor precision for the physicians. Oftentimes a very awkward handling experience. And you see this with friction and torque issues that come up that are unexpected, you know, in that early design process. Sometimes you even see engineers add extra complexity into the system to try to overcome these issues, just to work around the design mismatch. And when the delivery tool gets reverse engineered onto an existing implant, oftentimes you end up with design compromises, a clunky interaction that can really frustrate physicians, slow down procedures, and even increase risk of the procedure.
And we're seeing in the delivery, we're seeing advances of new technologies like robotics and high-res imaging and guidance systems, sort of reshaping interventional procedures. What demands do those new technologies put on the delivery systems, and how do those interact with the implant design choices?
Great question. These technologies are really raising the performance bar of the delivery systems. Mm-hmm. The delivery systems need to be highly visible under all different kinds of imaging modalities, fluoro, IVUS, OCT, CT. You know, they need to be digitally compatible, not just with marker bands, but with integrated sensors, RFID tags, or even real-time data capture. They also need to mechanically play nice with those robotic systems. And that means having really low friction and being highly steerable. On the implant side, the designs are evolving also. Radiopaque markers, geometries that better align for imaging guidance. And AI is pushing things even further, driving predictive deployment modeling, which means both implants and digital systems need to be more standardized and reproducible.
So as you're saying that, I'm realizing that you probably really need to be, you need to work together right at the start to design both the implant and the delivery system. What are the risks of waiting too long?
Ideally, the delivery system's part of the conversation when you're initially sketching out that implant. You know, the earlier you're working on it, the better. If you wait too long, you risk multiple redesigns. You get poor feedback potentially from those early physician interactions, perhaps even poor performance in your development testing in critical situations. That can lead to regulatory delays because the system doesn't validate properly. It's just a lot easier and faster to plan that delivery system earlier rather than later.
Well, Chris, can you share an example of where early integration of an implant and delivery system, where the teams work together and improve product performance or maybe accelerated the development of device more quickly?
Sure. One project comes to mind right away. It's a braided stent delivery system that needed an unusual deployment mechanism. You know, we spoke earlier about some of these novel systems having stage releases or forcing some new designs in deployment. Well, this one had a very novel need to deploy proximal to distal. In most self-expanding systems, as you deploy them, they deploy distal to proximal. So this required a custom delivery system with a suture release mechanism. And because we designed the implant release mechanism deployment system all together, we solved some issues like a length shift. A lot of times you bring a braided self-expanding system down, they elongate as they become smaller on the shaft, and then they'll form their natural length during deployment. And by using this suture release mechanism that allowed it to go proximal to distal from the very beginning, we cut about 6 months off of the development, and we were able to get into clinical trials in 11 months.
Wow. So how have virtual simulation tools like FEA and FSI and dynamic modeling, how do they enable more synchronized development of implants and delivery systems? And now are we actually seeing fewer surprises down the line with validation and clinical testing as a result?
Fewer surprises is exactly it. they let us predict how the implant and delivery systems will interact during deployment. They allow us to model different patient anatomies. And we can even test worst case scenarios virtually before we built the first device. And that means, like you said, fewer surprises. Fewer surprises when we do bench testing, fewer surprises in animal studies, and fewer surprises ultimately when we get into clinical testing. The teams can iterate faster at a lower cost, and we end up with stronger documentation for regulators along the way.
That's great. And we're focusing, I think, on the important part of the delivery systems and how they operate inside the body. But what about the user interaction, the human factors? What are the advantages? What advantages does early usability testing really provide when implant and delivery development are coordinated from the start?
Yeah, when you do usability testing early, you get to optimize things that the physicians really care about. Handle ergonomics, how it feels in their hand, and how they may sequence the device naturally. You know, many times as engineers, we know how we would use the device. We have an intuitive expectation, and we think others will use the device also. But all physicians are different. You know, they have different trainings, they have different ideas themselves, different preferences. Some are left-handed, some are right-handed. Some physicians are petite and some are really large. And so how they interact with the device oftentimes is not what the engineers expect, especially when you've got a new technology that's using a or needs a new type of delivery system. So that early usability testing allows us to understand how the physicians interact with the device. You get to spot intuitive use issues very early before they're locked into the design. And when the implant and delivery systems work together from the start, that usability testing reflects real-world use and not just theory. That ultimately makes the devices safer, it's easier adoption for the physicians, and becomes a less of a training burden for the companies as they go into the clinical use.
Interesting. Looking at the industry and companies where implant and delivery systems operate in silos, what cultural or organizational shifts are needed to really support a more integrated R&D effort?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I would just add that it's not just companies that are doing these internally. And many times that's the case. But what we're seeing here at Aptix is sometimes companies are wanting to maintain one of these technologies in-house, and they may be allowing a contract developer to do the delivery system. Or sometimes they're doing the delivery system and they want us to do the implants. And that can be a challenge. And it's really important that everyone has a systems mindset. We have cross-functional teams. The teams have shared KPIs. There's early involvement from quality, manufacturing, and leadership. And everyone has to aim for system success.
That's a great overview, Chris. Really appreciate your focusing a light on an area of technology of implants that I think I often overlook. So, Chris Dedham, thank you for joining us on the FOMO series.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to this episode's Future of MedTech Opportunities featuring Chris Stedham of Aptix. And now, in honor of World Heart Day that's coming up Monday, September 29th, Managing Editor Device Talks Kayleen Brown, that's me, gets to sit down with Jyoti Gura, CEO of Cardiovascular and Interventional Solutions at GE Healthcare. Cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death globally. So Jyoti and I unpack those statistics. We unpack GE Healthcare's extensive cardiovascular portfolio under her leadership, and Jyoti gives me the skinny on GE Healthcare's D3 strategy. That's devices, disease states, and digital, and why that's central to GE Healthcare's precision care model, of course, aiming to deliver more connected and effective patient outcomes. And I can't have an interview without asking about artificial intelligence. So we dig into how GE Healthcare is leveraging AI at every stage of the care pathway, from screening to diagnosis to intervention. Happy World Heart Day, and I hope you enjoy this interview with Jyoti Gura, CEO of Cardiovascular and Interventional Solutions at GE Healthcare.
I'm so excited to welcome today's guest, Jyoti Gura, CEO of Cardiovascular and Interventional Solutions for GE Healthcare. Jyoti, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
The timing, Jyoti, of our conversation is absolutely perfect. World Heart Day is September 29th, so I'd love to learn more first about cardiovascular disease, and then I'd like to get your perspective on innovation in heart health. So before we dig into that, I want to get to know you a little bit more. How did you get into med tech? I mean, what was the journey that brought you to our conversation today?
Thank you. Thank you for the question. Getting into med tech, I mean, this was about, I want to say, 23 years ago. So I was born and brought up in India. I live in Boston right now. I was born in a very typical middle-class Indian family. We were all taught that we either have to be doctors or engineers. And I was keenly interested in product development and engineering. So at the behest of my dad, at the time, I went to engineering school, graduated, and very keenly looking forward to sort of, you know, how can I build the next big product that could do something meaningful, if you will. That was about the time, this was about a year before I joined GE Healthcare. And my foray into GE Healthcare, though, was right after dealing with heart disease in my family. My dad, in fact, right after I graduated engineering school, he had a sudden onset of a heart attack and he passed from an MI. I was very young at the time. And I think, you know, that started a little bit of a journey for me. It was this quest to understand what really happened here. Like presumably we thought he had no risk factors, right? But that was clearly not the case. So this quest to understand more led me, I think, on this journey. It was around the time, I think it was serendipity, that GE Healthcare came calling, and I jumped right in. I was like, I absolutely need to understand more. And I've stayed here, as you can see, all these years, fully vested, if you will, in that purpose. You know, we have a purpose that we created together 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, when we formed GE Healthcare as a company, of creating a world where healthcare has no limits. So that sort of very deeply resonates. And I think that early interest and the continued interest in technology and bringing in the human element for me, how you can make human impact with what you build and create, has just kept me going here. So every innovation that we've done, every project that brings care closer to community, if you will, just helps a clinician make a better and faster decision that resonates with me. And that's why I'm still here.
Warms my heart, Jyoti. This is a commonality, I think, when we talk to stakeholders in the medical device industry. It's turning either pain into purpose or having this mission-driven approach. And we all have stories. I can't even say a story, but we all have multiple stories that continue to drive that mission and continue to inspire that passion. And I love hearing, even though the origin of that passion is heartbreaking, and I'm so sorry that you and your family and your friends had to experience that. That pain turning into purpose, that saves lives, and that's meaningful.
Absolutely.
So Jyoti, as I understand it, you lead the cardiovascular and interventional solutions business at GE Healthcare. Can you tell us more about that business and what that product portfolio looks like?
Absolutely. And then perhaps CVIS is what we call the business, the cardiovascular and interventional solutions. Perhaps I introduce that in the context of GE Healthcare. Right? As GE Healthcare, we have the largest end-to-end cardiology portfolio, like many would know. And we provide solutions for the entire pathway. And when I say pathway, we mean screening for a disease, detecting and diagnosing it, intervening as necessary, and then monitoring patients. So broadly speaking, in this whole journey, we are focused on telling the story of the heart, if you will. Within CVIS, and we formed this division about a year ago now, what we did is we brought together multiple technologies that are involved in this diagnosis and intervention into one customer-centered team. This technology, for example, our technology includes ultrasound cardiac imaging, which is our Vivid portfolio. And ultrasound is used to diagnose heart disease, to assess heart structure and function. It includes advanced X-ray imaging that are used for minimally invasive and interventional procedures. So when you hear someone says, I need to go to the cath lab, that's a catheterization lab, and that's where you have a real-time X-ray imaging with image guidance to guide procedures. So these are two technologies amongst others. We integrate with multiple other imaging modalities. We have recording systems, multiple diagnostic systems. And the idea was bring these together, build an integrated solution for this pathway, which is very uniquely centered, I think, around unique customers. And these customers, for example, span cardiologists, echocardiographers, sonographers, interventionalists, as an example, and then they tend to run some of the busiest and most outcome critical services in a cardiology service line in a health system.
Well, speaking of critical cardiovascular cardio systems, you're absolutely right. So let's talk about cardiovascular disease, especially coming up to World Heart Day. Why? Two things. One, can you give us just a brief understanding of what is cardiovascular disease? And I'm talking about very brief because we could spend our hour just on that alone. And then after we get that understanding, help us understand, why is GE Healthcare so focused on cardiovascular disease? I mean, why did you a year ago or so create this business unit to support this?
Absolutely. So cardiovascular disease is a very broad term. In very simple terms, it is heart disease. And this could be disease coming as a chronic illness. It could be acute. It could be congenital. And it could involve, for example, coronary arteries around the heart. It could involve structural issues, for example, with your aortic valve or your tricuspid valve. It could be flow-limiting lesions that exist in vasculature even outside the heart. That's the cardiovascular part of that. So it's a very broad term for coronary artery disease, for arrhythmias and fibrillations, which is called electrophysiology, and structural heart disease. And a broader umbrella, which could be heart failure, which comes from multiple different etiologies, if you will, but culminates in the heart not necessarily functioning in a way that it should.
Excellent. So then that helps us sort of unpack what that term is. Again, it's a huge umbrella term. Why was it so important for GE Healthcare to focus on cardiovascular disease, and why is it important?
Yes. So GE Healthcare, and often I'm asked this question, why this acute focus, if you will, on CVD for short, cardiovascular disease. I like to always start, Kayleen, with the sheer scale of the challenge, right? I mean, heart disease is clearly, and many in this audience know that, it is the leading cause of death worldwide. It's also, in fact, the leading cause of what we call as disability-adjusted life years, which is essentially the amount of healthy life that one might lose because of a debilitation or a disability, right? So clearly, the human toll, the economic toll is massive. That's, I think, part of the interest. And, you know, the prevalence is staggering. I mean, while we've got hundreds of millions of people that live even today with heart disease, there are projections that tell us that by 2050, about 60% of our population will have some form of CVD in the US alone, right? Wow. And then you shift your lens to low and middle income countries where the burden is rising even faster, and worse still, the access to specialists is somewhat limited. And the other element I'll bring about is, you know, most heart diseases fundamentally are chronic issues. You know, they build silently over time. And the risk factors are increasingly well known: diabetes, obesity, hypertension. So while this is a chronic disease, it too often declares itself as an acute event, whether that's a heart attack or a stroke, while it's been really progressing for a long time. And that is truly the opportunity, right? Because as GE Healthcare, when we look at this opportunity, we think about what does it take to shift care upstream, which is, can you detect, can you intervene way earlier before this turns into a crisis? And so we are diagnosing too late. clearly, often when the damage is already done. And then we have healthcare systems that are largely fragmented, which is patients are sort of bouncing between specialists before they really get a diagnosis. We have data that doesn't necessarily connect. So your outcomes vary, right? Depending on which geography you're in, depending on which health system you get into, sometimes which physician you see, you just have access issues, you have variability of outcome issues, and which is why GE Healthcare is interested. It's a massive problem to solve. And as I laid out the care pathways, when you think of disease states as screening, detection, diagnosis, intervention, and then following up on patients, we sort of align our efforts, our technologies, our advocacy, our commercial efforts around how do you address the most pressing disease states, and really CVD falls in that journey, in that entire mission that we have. So the focus is the pathway and not just isolated moments that may show up in multiple ways across the journey.
Not only are those numbers staggering and concerning, I can absolutely see why this is such a point of importance for GE Healthcare. And I love how you said that it's a big focus is intervention sooner than later. I think that's absolutely key. And then you talked about some of the challenges or the obstacles for patients seeking care or seeking treatment. So maybe we can unpack that. If you highlighted the umbrella terminology, cardiovascular disease, can we choose one disease state and then that would require a patient to need intervention? And then can you walk us through what that journey would look like just so we better understand really the scope of what we're dealing with?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's a great way to sort of visualize this, right? And while we are focused on a few different disease states, perhaps what I will do is I will pick CAD, coronary artery disease. I suspect it's one that many are familiar with. It's a very common disease state, if you will. This is where you have a plaque building up in the heart, in the arteries of the heart. And eventually for some patients or many, it might mean an intervention. For example, you have a stent that is put in your heart, right? So when you think of the early stages of this journey, it shows up in a very ordinary way. You know, a patient shows up with chest discomfort. They may show up typically with risk factors, high cholesterol, diabetes, and what have you. But before they show up with chest pain or angina to an ED, CAD, it remains asymptomatic for many years, which is a part of the problem as well, right? There are sometimes no obvious signs till you present with chest pain. In the modern day, of course, there are modern biomarkers that can help us detect what's brewing beneath the surface, if you will, before the first symptoms show up. But that doesn't always get detected. The first tests when you show up are very simple. You do an ECG in the clinic. You may do a stress test. You usually get an echocardiogram that helps understand how the heart is pumping. And often these tools will indicate the first few abnormalities, but they still don't paint the full picture. Because what you want to know is, okay, if there is a lesion in a given artery, how flow limiting is it? Do I intervene or do I medically manage? You need to make those decisions right at that step. And here is where sometimes the pathway can get difficult, right? I mean, you may have situations where you get your ECGs done in a place, you have an echo done elsewhere, you get referred for a follow-up stress test that happens elsewhere. And clinicians today are sort of literally piecing this information together, you know, in multiple disparate systems. And this fragmentation often costs time, and time that you can't lose in a disease state like CAD. So if you go to the next step, you know, typically, advanced imaging is needed, depending on the geography you're at, depending on the insurance you're at. I mean, that is, again, sometimes where care gets fragmented because you may have to wait for months before you get the next line test. But if you do get to the advanced imaging, today, advanced imaging has really changed the game. And I'll give you an example. For example, many patients will get a cardiac CT. At this stage. And the cardiac CTs now, they don't just show you the arteries. Technology has advanced where we can now quantify the actual burden of calcium in the arteries. And you can sort of say, okay, you can characterize, even if there isn't K calcium, if there is early plaque, you can characterize it. What is it? What is the composition of that? And you do that non-invasively. You estimate physiology non-invasively, which is very powerful. And this is where now the triage happens, depending on the results of your cardiac CT. Some patients will be sent to lifestyle and medicine. Some patients will sort of say, okay, you need a closer follow-up. Some will be sent inevitably to the cath lab. And now life gets interesting because let's say you go into the cath lab and the complexity could show up here, right? Often if there's a simple case, you have like a single lesion stent, usually it is straightforward. But many patients show up with multiple lesions. Right, they show up with diffuse disease. They show up with vessels that may be heavily calcified, if you will. And sometimes they show up with prior stents that go through what we call as restenosis. And these are hard cases, right? Now you have an interventionalist in this lab that we call the cath lab that has to choose, okay, which of these lesions do I treat? How do I navigate calcium? What stent do I put in and how do I ensure that the stent is put in properly? And we have many new tools in these days that help sort of, you know, crack calcium so you can safely put a stent in. Increasingly, we personalize stents, right? So you select the size, the length, where do you land the stent? You select it very precisely for each patient. This isn't like a generic template. And then with some of the technology we do today, which we can talk about in a future state, we ideally want all those CT images that you just got, we want them to flow seamlessly into the cath lab. We want the operator to have a one-stop look at, okay, here are all the priors of this patient ahead of when the patient shows up on the table. You shouldn't be doing this when the patient is already on the table. So you need to be able to plan this ahead of time and personalize a plan for how you're going to treat a given patient. And during the intervention, again, we have many, many technologies with advanced imaging, advanced guidance, so the lesion can be treated properly. You can have the right stent placement. You can verify before the patient leaves the lab, as opposed to asking them to come back later for another exam. Right then and there, can you evaluate your first pass success and avoid a rerun, if you will? And finally, I'll end here. I mean, even if the stent goes in really beautifully, the journey is not over, right? Because these patients now need very close follow-up. They need their ECGs to be checked. You need echoes to check your heart function. And ideally, in a future world, we have these seamless digital systems that pull all the follow-on information, just so if there is deterioration, you can catch it early. You can sort of adjust medication, adjust therapy, and prevent a readmission, if you will.
This is more than what I could have hoped for. What you walked us through is, at its basis core, it's scary. It's incredibly scary for the patient and their loved ones and their advocates. But there is something to be said about understanding what that journey looks like in advance. Mr. Rogers says if it's mentionable, it's manageable. So talking about the journey, I think, just is step one into managing the journey. So I really appreciate that. And I also understand that journey more. And I've been in the industry almost 2 decades. So Jyoti, thank you very much. A few things caught my ear as you kind of walked us through the pathway. And I think you were walking us to how technology could maybe improve outcomes. And I kept thinking, possibly AI. So what role does AI play in cardiology care?
Yeah, and let's dig into that. And I'm glad we did the patient journey because hopefully it helps see better what are the problems we are trying to solve, right? AI as a technology can do a lot of things, but that's not where we start. So let's recap the problems. Number one, patients are diagnosed too late. Number two, all of us know that clinicians are overloaded everywhere in the world, in fact. Number three, care is fragmented, right? So what's the role of AI in this sort of a setup? And remember, cardiology generates a lot of data, right? I mean, you have ECGs, you have echoes, you have CT labs, lots of data coming from wearables, biomarkers, you know, clinician notes. And yet, we don't detect the disease too early, even though we are sitting on all of this data. So for me, really, AI, the role of AI is to fix the system. Can we shift detection earlier? Can we reduce variability, get better outcomes? Can we connect the pathway for patients? And fundamentally, care has to be more personalized, and therapy that you give a patient has to be precise and tailored to that patient. That's sort of the broad lens with which we have to think about how a technology such as AI in augmentation with other technologies can help us. So first, let's talk a little bit about what I call as left shifting of care. Okay, you visualize the pathway, and when you want to left shift care, you want to catch the disease earlier. And how do we do that with AI? So, you know, not only do you want to catch, to catch the disease earlier, you want to train more people, and you want to train them to do it well, right? And let's take the humble ECG, because it's everywhere, right? I mean, ECG is, it's inexpensive, it's fast. And what can you do with AI today on that same ECG? You can flag really subtle patterns that may be suggestive of a disease state, signals that typically otherwise even the human eye couldn't necessarily catch that could have been missed, right? For example, you know, we have, and actually many, many companies have these deep learning tools where you can analyze millions of ECGs. And what you're looking for is these subtle signs of remodeling of electrical remodeling, I must say, right? That these signs precede an actual, either a mechanical dysfunction or any sort of a clinical symptom that shows up, right? And these AI-powered tools can find diseases like atrial fibrillation, or if your heart pump is not working well enough, they can find it much earlier with very, very standard, better than standard interpretation today. And this could be a triage to actually move to advanced imaging sooner. And you actually see a lot of this left shift today, even with echo. Traditionally, and when I say echo, this is ultrasound of the heart. Traditionally, it takes years of training to do ultrasound. But with AI, and we have solutions in the market now where you can have less experienced users, novice users, acquire good high-quality image views. You can automate measurements, like standard measurements, and you can do things like, you know, one-click ejection fraction, make it easier to get a strain analysis, and then highlight these abnormalities. That could then sort of expand access. It could bring consistency and shift care faster to the next step. And the second piece is, I think, if we don't solve for productivity and giving clinicians time back with AI, we would have missed something, because that's where, again, it shines in its potential for what it can do. Cardiology, you know, by definition, it's just measurement heavy. You know, you just have so many repeated measurements you need to do, the quantification that needs to happen. So AI can do all of that for you. Even today, you know, you can surface the right studies from, you know, what happened to the patient before. You can, with Gen AI, pretty much pre-populate the reports for the clinician to look at, and just automate everything that is very routine. And it's important to make the point here that it isn't to replace expertise. Right. I mean, it is really to reduce the cognitive load so you spend more time with patients. And finally, you know, I think AI can, and I feel very passionately about, you know, removing the fragmentation of the clinical care pathway. It can absolutely do that. I mean, a typical cardiac patient, like we just saw, you know, you could touch emergency, you could touch primary care, you could touch imaging. You could go through the cath lab, and then you have a whole rehab in front of you, and the data is all scattered, right? It's multimodal data, which is everywhere, ECG, echo, labs, wearable, CT, what have you. So if we can stitch all of that together into one single evolving patient story, I think you can do things like, you know, identify which patient is going to benefit at what point in time with what therapy, and then tailor that therapy to be very precise to the patient. And I won't go there, but there is so much that we are doing with AI, even just within the interventional labs, how to make it more precise, how to signal risks early on, act before a crisis. So I'll end this with saying, look, I mean, from my perspective, there's almost a perfect storm for AI in cardiology. On the one hand, you have a huge disease burden. On the other, you have like these massive structured data sets in many cases. So you can create, you know, real-time clinical impact. And there is regulatory momentum. How do you build evidence? How do you show outcomes? That's really the holy grail. And we are all, you know, sort of going in that direction. But this is sort of, hopefully, I gave you a sense of a broad landscape of where AI can make a difference.
Yes. So I'm so passionate about artificial intelligence. And for our audience who's listening, pull out your bingo cards, because I'm going to say what I say every single time when I think about artificial intelligence, is that it's not, to your point, Jyoti, it's not taking anything away. It is allowing humans to be more human. And that is so powerful. So if artificial intelligence is able to help us intervene earlier, to find patterns that we haven't seen before, to really interpret this onslaught of data that is, it's in itself a massive problem, and to provide better outcomes, I mean, that is a win-win-win. And that doesn't even touch on, you know, helping with the workforce and the need for more care team members to come and help. And just, again, it's, for me, so exciting to think about this huge leap forward and how our industry is really embracing artificial intelligence, and that we can make sure that it is something that stays within the industry and continues to, again, help with those better outcomes. So Jyoti, as I recall, GE Healthcare has led the FDA's list of AI-enabled medical device authorizations for the fourth year in a row, with 100 in the U.S. So first, congratulations. Does GE Healthcare have aspirations for more?
Absolutely. I mean, we are just on an unstoppable journey, I think. I mean, you know, we are embedding AI not just into our devices, but into actually putting them into workflows, into digital platforms, so that whenever a patient enters a system, whether he or she enters it at the clinic with an ECG, an ED, an echo lab, or a cath lab, we can get care to be more consistent and earlier. And all the ways in which I described AI, we are just scratching the surface. So the answer is a resounding yes.
Oh, that's so exciting. I think about the future today compared to 2 decades ago, and it felt like, I always said that industry is at least 10 years behind most other industries. And in many ways, AI is helping us catch up. It's giving clinicians time back and everything else that we already have talked through. But again, that's the passion. That's the excitement for me. That's what helps me wake up every single day thinking we are making a difference, and not just an iterative difference, a huge leap forward difference every single day. And that is just, oh, this is the best industry in the world.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You're spot on there. And, you know, while today, when you think of where we are at in this whole journey with AI, there is so much evidence that has been built up around workflow and consistency, training more clinicians, and some of these practical wins that clinicians feel. But as we sort of continue the journey for GE Healthcare, I think we are really working on what are those hard outcomes, and how can we just sort of show fewer hospitalizations, just show lower total cost of care, and what are the endpoints, honestly, that are going to shift the whole reimbursement pathways as well. So it's an evolving journey, but that's sort of where we are focused on, building this real-world evidence in conjunction with our clinical partners.
And that's the MedTech way. I love that so much. So let's shift, Jyoti, to precision care. How is GE Healthcare moving toward enabling precision care in cardiology?
Yes, that's a great question. So let's define precision care in very simple terms. For me, it's, you know, making the right decision for the right patient at the right time. That's essentially what precision care is about in very simple terms. And so, like I said before, we do have one of the broadest portfolios across the entire cardiac care pathway. But our CEO frames it this way, so I think I'm going to borrow on that framing. We organize our strategy for precision care through what we call as D3, right? And let me explain that. So D3 is the first D stands for devices that are smarter. The second stands for disease states. So that's sort of this laser focus on particular disease states where we are going to change the whole care journey. And the third stands for digital, which is sort of the glue to bring all of these together. And I'll just give you a little bit of an explanation on them that hopefully helps talk to the strategy for GE Healthcare in terms of cardiology. So let's start with devices. So in what you can do with devices, when I say devices, these are, you know, the entire ecosystem, for example, for us is screening solutions such as Caption AI. It could be handheld ultrasound that's used in communities to screen for a disease. It could be our diagnostic platforms all the way from 12-lead ECG to an echo to a cardiac CT that I talked about, or a cardiac MR and PET. And we, in fact, recently launched for Flyrcado our myocardial perfusion imaging, which is a huge leap forward as well. So this is the entire spectrum of devices that are used to characterize disease, if you will. And what can we do with these? I mean, when we talk about making devices smarter for precision care, I'll give you a couple of examples. I, in fact, just returned yesterday from Madrid, where we were at the ESC show, the European Society of Cardiology Congress 2025, where we launched our Vivid Pioneer. I mean, this is our next-gen ultra-premium cardiovascular imaging system, right? So, I mean, we clearly, in this case, it's a smart device, right? We bring the next-gen imaging, whether that is just basic 2D, 4D, color flow, all into that device, but also heavily lean on automation. How can we use AI for measurements? How can we use AI in, for example, in this case, the smart device is able to automate real-time guidance for structural heart procedures, and that drives speed, it drives accuracy, it drives precision, if you will. Another example might be, you know, in the journey of a CAD for a patient, we talked about the difficulty in the interventional room, right? And our smart interventional room has this feature where we are able to visualize a stent in 3D, where essentially we are picking the live X-ray or the angio images, reconstructing 3D imaging with that. And that allows you in real time to understand whether you've placed the stent correctly and to confirm the stent. So this, again, it's improving precision. It's sort of reducing the number of redo procedures you might have to do. So that sort of intelligence for precision that is built into the device at the point of care, at the point where the device is actually used, right? So that's an example of how we think about, can our devices reduce diagnostic delays, right? Can we do with lesser imaging versus more imaging? So that's essentially a smart device. Disease states. Now, a disease state is where we organize around the big cardiac journeys. You know, we talked about the coronary artery disease. We are focused on EP, which is atrial fibrillation, structural heart, amongst others. And we asked just three simple questions. And I sound like a broken record because this is essentially what we talk about day in and day out. How do we move things upstream? How do you reduce delay? How do you catch disease earlier? Within the procedure, how can you help a clinician better plan, better guide the procedure for better outcomes? And then how do you keep patients moving downstream, monitoring, timely follow-up? So what we do now is now combine the right modalities, the right services into what answers these questions for the disease state. And that's how you can actually move the needle versus focusing on one technology and one problem at a time, yes. Right? So it's a combination, yes, of doing both. And we talked about the example of left-shifting care in many cases. Finally, digital, right? Here is where we want to connect the journey. We want one single pane of glass to inform the full longitudinal story for the patient. And we have multiple IT solutions in our case that enable you to layer workflow apps, that enable you to standardize reporting, you know, speeden up the reads, faster triage, ensure that the handoffs from one state of the disease, from one position in the pathway to the other is just better and drive this personalized therapy, if you will. So putting it all together, so that I just say that this D3 strategy is a framing for how we can impact precision care. So I think in the future, you know, ideally you have patients that are recording their ECGs through wearables at home. You have paramedics in an ambulance even before they reach the emergency department, transmitting data and sort of, you know, having smarter interventional guidance and follow up with one single data spine. I think that's sort of how you make precision care real.
It's a very helpful way of thinking about it. And I will comment on it's, you're not a broken record. Arguably, that's the most important record. And we should be listening to that always, always, always as that guidepost. You know, that's really how we should approach innovation. So I love to hear it. Do you have any other thoughts about precision care before I bring us to the future?
Yeah, no, let's talk about the future. Let's go dive straight in.
Let's dig in then. So from your perspective, what does the future look like in cardiology care at GE Healthcare?
So, you know, when I think about the future, it's almost almost more useful to describe it in terms of how care might feel different for a patient, right?
Ooh, I like
for
that.
You and me and any of the patients, you know, in the future, how does it look different? And how does it look different for a clinician, right? That's really the way in which we orchestrate. And then that's our North Star. We want to walk towards that future, right? So, you know, simpler, earlier, more connected, better outcomes. If I were to just put this whole thing in a nutshell, that's what we want to do. And we drive that through our D3 strategy. And we just finished, you know, we are in this time of the year where we go through our roadmaps, our solution, you know, visioning exercises. And then honestly, this is what is reflected in the vision for CVIS and cardiology care going forward. So I'm always asking, and we are always asking the question, every solution that you provide, are we simplifying a workflow? Are we expanding access? Is this going to contribute to elevate the standard of care through the journey, right? That's essentially what our roadmaps, you know, show. And I do think over the coming years and decades, we will see some seismic shifts, right? I go back to that everyday entry point because I feel so passionately about that. ECGs are in primary care. This is an everyday entry point, right? Handheld and echo are in clinics and in community sites, and they will be even more prevalent in the coming years. These have to be reliable places for us to find disease, right? And I think in the future, there is going to clearly be smart acquisition where you will have, you know, more users, sometimes more novice users doing these acquisitions. You will have automation to take variability out. And then, you know, intelligently guiding a procedure, what I call as procedural intelligence, I think it will become the standard of care, right? You shouldn't have a rerun. You shouldn't have outcomes that vary based on, you know, who is operating. So the first pass success, that's going to be the measure of yield, I think is going to go up for sure. And then finally, you know, with a lot of the digital solutions we are working on, we will have these very tailored and precise longitudinal care models for every disease state we bring to bear, right? We bring our technologies to bear. So we will have a single patient story, you know, that will follow the patient in their entire journey, that will sort of indicate risks early, will indicate when they need to do what, right? Which is not just for the patient, for the clinician, this one single pane of glass. And finally, you know, I'll end with saying we can build all of these technologies, but the key is adoption, right? And that's for many of us who've been in the medtech industry, we know it's easier said than done. And I think we'll be very transparent about how we drive adoption and build proof points, right? And I said this before, for today, a lot of the gains we are seeing is in efficiency, in consistency, and we will continue to do that. But we will then continue to work on how do we bring these technologies to scale. Generalizability of AI, are the AI algorithms we are developing as fit for purpose in the US as they are in any other place of the world? And we are working very hard to build this ecosystem of partners. And I should have said this before, we can't go at this alone. We fully understand that. I mean, especially in cardiology, innovation is coming from everywhere. right? But on the other hand, if you have these point innovations that are dispersed in disparate systems and the pathway doesn't help you, how can we stitch that workflow together? And we as being the orchestrators of that workflow, if you will, that's where we are headed, right? And then this isn't theoretical. I think we are already making giant leaps. So, you know, honestly, I couldn't be more excited. And I would, in fact, invite the entire ecosystem, because I'm sure you've got a diversity of people on this podcast to join us in this journey.
There's so much I want to say, so I will reduce it to this. When you walked us through the patient journey, it felt more manageable, felt less scary. When we think about what you and your fellow leaders and your team members are doing for industry, and how you've unpacked our conversation today makes the future of medtech feel more hopeful, less scary, feels like we are on the verge of making an even more meaningful difference. And having people like you, Jyoti, in those leadership positions is more of a privilege and a pleasure than I could possibly communicate. So thank you so much, Jyoti Guerra, CEO, Cardiovascular and Interventional Solutions for GE Healthcare. Thank you for joining us on the podcast and for making me feel way more hopeful about this industry that I love so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Kaylin. It's been an honor. Thanks for having me.
All right, well, that is a wrap. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of Device Talks Weekly. I got three things for you. Number one, join us at Device Talks West on October 15th and 16th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. Go to west.devicetalks.com to register. If you have any questions, make sure you reach out to me on LinkedIn, which leads me to number two. Make sure you connect with us on LinkedIn. Connect with me, connect with Chris Newmark, connect with Kaylin Brown. We'd love to be part of your future podcast, your future MedTech conversations. Number three, make sure you join us on Tuesday. We've got our Device Talks Tuesdays coming up with our friends at Aptix. Go to devicetalks.com to register. And I'll throw in a bonus one, if you don't mind. Please subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network so you don't miss a future episode of our great Device Talks podcast. All right, folks. That, again, is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of Device Talks Weekly.